actually what I wanted to announce is that there's a door prize today. You get the opportunity to win this beautiful poster of Strings 2005. You cannot go to the store and buy this poster, but you can win it in a draw at the end of this lecture. And the way that you get to enter that draw is you have to ask a question. Beyond that, Richard gets to make up all the rules, and I'm not responsible for any of that. I am happy to take all your questions, but like Richard said, I have to emphasize, there aren't always going to be answers. If there were answers to all the questions, I wouldn't have a job. Okay. So, what are we going to talk about today? Well, I want to give you a flavor for string theory. What is it that we're doing? What do we think string theory is? Where do we think we're going? String theory is something that seems to have snuck into the popular culture, as this cartoon from the New Yorker suggests. It's the new Greek or the new rocket science. There have been a lot of popular books now, or at least four here that I've shown, that have been written about string theory for the layman. You know, some people here think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Some people over here think the bread has gone moldy. But we'll see. You can form your own opinion at the end of the day. Now, string theory is a search for new physics, and so it's about a journey into the future. And so the way I like to talk about string theory, though, is by starting with a reflection on the past to see where that journey has come from. And so what I like to do, what I'm going to do, is I'm going to start by talking about where we've come from with physics in the 20th century. And so as I've drawn it here, there were all sorts of different ideas, but a recurring theme in the physics of the 20th century was the unification or a synthesis of those what seemed to be disparate ideas, and those unifications giving birth to even new ideas, new perspectives on the physical universe. So that's a great set of words, but what the heck is he really talking about? Well, let's take a look at this picture and just take a peek at that corner. What do I really mean there? Well, one of the topics here that's listed is thermodynamics. Now, this was really the nanotechnology of the 19th century. For the first time, people were able to manufacture, to manipulate, construct things on a millimeter scale. And that allowed them to build these beasts here. And that really transformed our Western society. But to understand how those things worked or how to make them work better, physicists became more and more interested in the topic of thermodynamics and what are the properties of things when you heat them up and how do they behave when you compress them and things like that. Now on the other side here, I've got electromagnetism. Now in the 19th century, electromagnetism was really in its infancy. People were fooling around with magnets still, fooling around with circuits, trying to understand what was going on. And in fact, in the middle of the 1800s, it was James Maxwell who suggested there was an electromagnetism that unified the ideas of magnetic fields with the ideas of electric fields. But it was really a new idea. It was an abstract idea that people were playing with. They weren't really sure what it was good for, but they were curious about how things worked. Now, I've got these arrows saying that thermodynamics and electromagnetism come together. So they come together somewhere. What does that really mean? Well, it's something that we're all familiar with. When you heat things up enough, what they do is they glow. They start emitting electromagnetic radiation. And this, it turns out, posed a real conundrum for theoretical physicists and their understanding. And really, to resolve that conundrum, it gave birth to a whole new field of physics. We had to think about subatomic things in a completely different way. It gave rise to quantum mechanics and the idea of discrete energies and packets of light. And, of course, that's something now that, again, transformed the way that our Western society works. It gave birth to all sorts of great ideas, both on the screen and all around us here in this room. So that's the kind of idea that I'm trying to represent in this picture, where two apparently disparate concepts in theoretical physics came together and gave birth to yet another perspective or a new set of ideas. And at the end of the 20th century, where we are is everything really rests on two pillars, general relativity and something that I call quantum field theory. So what one of the most remarkable things about these two pillars in theoretical physics is how different they really are. They're completely different kinds of theories. So just to get a flavor for that, let's think about Einstein's general relativity. So the first thing he did actually wasn't general relativity, but special relativity. And there, it was a rather, again, profound idea. The Newtonian physicists thought that we have space that we measure with our rulers or our meter sticks, and we have time that we measure with our clocks. And that they were completely different concepts and completely different entities. By thinking about things moving very fast, what Einstein learned is that, in fact, space and time are inextricably linked. And we shouldn't think of them as different, but we should think of them together in a unified way in something that he called the space-time. In that framework, when he started to try and understand Newtonian gravity or incorporate the ideas of gravity, what he found is the way to do that was to endow this space-time with an interesting geometry. So rather than thinking that we live in flat space, where two parallel lines are always parallel and never meet, we should think in terms of curved space, where lines, parallel lines, or what gets replaced by the idea of geodesics, can move around and apparently move closer or move further apart, depending on the local geometry or how the space-time is shaped. Now, that seems a very esoteric idea. Things fall down, we know that. We see that all the time. And now I'm telling you that you have to learn differential geometry to understand that. So why do people care so much about general relativity? Well, it's because it's really a profound new perspective, a new way to think about the physical universe. It gave rise to an enormous set of new ideas. So the idea that I guess you were just hearing about, that there can be regions of space-time where the gravitational fields or the geometry is so curved that nothing can escape, not even light. When you combine, what physicists saw was that when they combined electromagnetism or electricity and magnetism in a relativistic theory, that gave rise to the idea that there were waves in the electromagnetic field. Similarly, when you incorporate gravity into a relativistic theory, you get waves that propagate in the space-time or ripples in the geometry. Similarly, it gave rise to the idea of an expanding universe so that we could understand cosmology in terms of geometry again. But the real reason that people believe in general relativity, or the reason it made it into the textbooks, is for a really pragmatic reason. That is that we can go out and we can do experiments and we can see that our physical universe is described or has effects that are described by general relativity. And so here's a list of different kinds of experiments, measurements that people have made. This graph shows one particular experiment where through very precise observations of a pair of stars or pulsars that are some astronomical distance away or cosmological distance away, they saw that the orbit changed in a very particular way. And general relativity made a prediction for how that orbit should be changing. And what you can see in this graph is that for measurements made over a period of almost 30 years, general relativity is precisely matching the observations that we made. And so that was, well, a technical tour de force to make those measurements to that precision, but it was also seen as an experiment or a set of observations worthy of a Nobel Prize some number of years ago. Another remarkable thing is that at this point in time, general relativity isn't just an esoteric idea. It's something that's sneaking its way into commercial applications. If you go down to Best Buy or Walmart and buy one of these nifty global positioning systems that you can stick in your car, make sure that you don't get lost, well, the engineers who built that had to take into account the effects both of general relativity and special relativity in order that they can work to the appropriate precision. If that wasn't taken into account, in a matter of seconds, the accuracy of these units would be start drifting off by some numbers of meters per hour, say. So what do we have? Well, general relativity, it's a source of new ideas. It's something that we've been able to, or scientists have been able to precisely test and confirm with experiments. But again, at its essence, what we have is a theory of geometry. It's a geometrical description of physical phenomena, but in particular, of physical phenomena at the very largest scale. We're talking about systems like planets, stars, galaxies, or in fact, the entire universe. Now, in contrast, when we start talking about quantum mechanics, we're talking about physics on the smallest possible scales that we can access. And we also change our mode of thinking. Instead of thinking about geometry, we start thinking about probabilities, about statistics, and wave functions and things like that. So in particular, one of the ideas that is central to quantum mechanics is the idea that particles can act like waves. And so there's this nifty formula invented in the 1930s or observed in the 1930s that any particle with a given momentum has a wavelength associated with it. And the conversion constant here is simply Planck's constant. Now I can apply that formula to something like a raindrop falling out of the sky. And if you go through the math, what you find out is that the wavelength that you calculate by that simple formula is something of this order, 4 times 10 to the minus 30 meters. Now, I'm not sure if this is something that you have to be reminded about, but just to emphasize it, what that means is I've got the decimal point, and then there are 29 zeros before I write down an interesting number. So that's a tiny, tiny wavelength. On the other hand, that raindrop that I'm talking about is something of the order of a millimeter, say. And so this kind of effect or this kind of wavelength is completely irrelevant when I'm talking about the physics of raindrops. And so here we have an experiment that I'll contrast in a second, but if I have a jet of water, I have a screen here, you know, the droplets of water here in my jet don't care at all about this uncertainty or this quantum feature. They just spray on through either that slit or that slit, and I get a wet spot on my screen here and another one here. Now, in contrast, what I can do is I can apply that same formula to something that's much smaller. In fact, the momentum for an electron in a typical situation, or that's something that's fairly easy to arrange, is a much smaller number, and so in fact I get a bigger wavelength. It's still a subatomic, or it's a very small wavelength, but it's some 20 orders of magnitude larger than the one I calculated there. It's a wavelength that's of the size of an atom, and so it's something that gets its own name because it's a useful unit, the angstrom. But in this case, we scale down our entire experiment. Now the screen, instead of being the size of centimeters or millimeters, and the slits are again, you know, I would have a thin gold film perhaps with razor blade slits here, which again are going to be nanometers across. And when I shoot my electron beam, the wave-like properties become important on this scale. And so I get a wave-like pattern on the screen behind. And so what that's telling you, or what that reinforces, is just the idea that quantum fluctuations or uncertainties become manifest in the behavior of very small particles. Quantum theory itself was something that we had to put together, or scientists put together, to come to grips with understanding physics at the atomic scale. Of course, scientists have gone on to understand or to probe the physical universe at shorter and shorter scales. And so here we are at the angstrom level. What we saw were atoms, where I had a nucleus surrounded by some electron cloud or wave function. If we probe even deeper, what we see is that that nucleus here at the center of the atom isn't just a point particle, but rather it's something that's a composite. It's composed, or it's a bound state formed of protons and neutrons. So now we're down to 10 to the minus 14 meters of resolution. If we go down one order of magnitude again, what we can see, or what we can detect, are that these protons and neutrons themselves are composites, and they're composed of things called quarks. And so the most precise experiments that we have right now resolve things at this order, 10 to the minus 17 meters, and the physics there is described by something called the Standard Model. And so now we're not just using quantum mechanics, but we're using an offspring of quantum mechanics known as quantum field theory. And so within this standard model of subatomic physics, there's a list of various particles here. Not just those particles with various names that may be familiar, like the electron, but also unfamiliar names, perhaps like the gluon over there. But we also, what this theory tells us is how those particles interact. And so, for example, if I have one of these W bosons, what the standard model says is that there's a certain process by which it decays into an electron and a neutrino. So we have a list of particles and a precise set of rules. It gives us a framework where we can calculate. And what that means is that we can test that theory. And so once again, quantum theory is a theory that's been rigorously tested to a very high accuracy. So one of my favorite examples here is the magnetic moment of an electron. Electron isn't just a point particle, it's a particle with spin, and along the axis of the spin, it's got a tiny magnetic moment. And that magnetic moment is described by a formula like this. Here are constants, they're sort of fundamental in nature, and then there's a constant G, it's just a number. In the leading order, what the theory says is that G should be just the number 2 sitting in that here. But in fact, the precise value... Oh, sorry, was there a question?
Yeah, that was my question. What is G exactly? What does it represent?
Well, there's a magnetic moment here, so that's something that you can feel with experiments, either by pulling it up or down in a magnetic field. But you can relate that value, and the theory says that it's related to the charge, to h-bar, and to the mass of the electron. So that's something that falls out of, at leading order, in some sense, it falls out of the equations that you write down.
So that's a parameter that we just plug in to make it work?
It's not something that I actually plugged in. The equations that I wrote down dictated, at the simplest level, that G was 2. But the point is that quantum fluctuations actually modify G to be slightly different than 2. And so you can go off and do an experiment here, and what you find is that G is in fact 2.02319304 blah, 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 blah. But what I said is we had a theory and we can calculate, and so other people can go off and they can calculate what G should be, and what they find is that G should be 2.023 blah, 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 blah. If you look carefully, what you see is that those two numbers aren't quite the same, but that we have agreement to 10 decimal places here. Now, this isn't an indication that there's a problem with the theory. It's an indication that, in fact, any experiment has a finite resolution. You can only get a certain accuracy with a given experiment in a given amount of time. Similarly, there's an enormous effort that goes into these calculations, and it's quantum theory gives us a systematic approach to calculate these corrections to 2, and there's an enormous amount of effort that's gone into getting you down to here, but it's known that there are corrections. It's known how to calculate that even more accurately. And so the fact that we have a disagreement here, or that there's only a 10 decimal or 10 digits of agreement, is simply a reflection of the exhaustion that both the experimentalists and the theorists face.
at this point in time. So, yeah, okay, so neither one of these numbers is absolutely correct, but they're correct to a finite accuracy. There are many other examples. Another favorite is so-called lamb shift, or a splitting between energy levels in the hydrogen atom. In fact, quantum fluctuations are the only, again, the source of a splitting between two levels. And again, it's something where the experiment and the theory agree to a high degree of accuracy. So just like general relativity, quantum theory is something that has been rigorously tested by experiments. It's also a theory that gave us a profound new perspective on the physical universe. And so it was a rich source of new ideas. And so here's just a list of a few of the ideas that, in some sense, emerged from quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, or quantum theory in general. And you might wonder where I got that list. And in fact, where I went to make up that list was the Nobel Prize webpage. You can just look at the Nobel Prizes that have been awarded in the past century, and what you find is that at some level, quantum mechanics was the heart of many of these new ideas that were, again, regarded as Nobel-worthy. Okay, so here we have subatomic physics. We have this list of particles. I've been going on and on for 20 minutes. The topic is supposed to be string theory. So this is finally where string theory comes in. The idea is that, well, this is a rather obscure or a strange set list of different kinds of particles. What string theory wants to do is it wants to unify all of these particles and say that they're actually different aspects of the same thing, of a string. And so the idea is that if I was able to look at those particles with sufficient resolution, I see that, in fact, they are all, in some sense, not point particles, but rather extended objects, extended in one dimension. The fact that their properties are different reflects the fact that they're vibrating in different ways or rotating in different ways at this very microscopic level. So what is that resolution? Well, what we think is that the typical size of a string is of the order of 10 to the minus 35 meters, or some 18 orders of magnitude smaller than the resolution we presently have in the best experiments. The standard model was not just a list of particles, it was also a set of rules on how those particles interacted. And so what about interactions in string theory? Well, I can think of two loops as being two strings. How do they interact? Well, they move closer to each other, and when they touch, the ends interconnect, or they open up, and you form a single loop. So that's an interaction that took us from two strings to one string. And so here's a cartoon. It's something that we can all do, string theory, with our hands. Here I've got one loop. Here I've got one loop. They come together, and they just open up into a single loop like that. Of course, this is a quantum theory, and so something that's harder to do with my hands is that often what will happen is they'll touch, and they won't do anything. They'll pass right through each other. There's a probability for this interaction to take place and for a single string to form there. And in string theory, that's called, or governed, that probability, that quantum feature of the theory is governed by the coupling constant. So there's some G that comes with string theory. And so basically, string theory is going to be governed by two parameters, the scale at which I expect to see the strings, or the typical size of the string, and this coupling constant that governs this sort of geometric interaction. And so it seems that with these simple rules, you have the appropriate tools or structures to derive or to get all of the appropriate particle species and interactions to match the standard model. Now, I don't want to say that we've reproduced the standard model. But what we know is that we have the right kind of structures to put them together in a way that the standard model can result. So there's a question. Here we have the particles of the standard model of physics. I said that, well, string theory hopes to unify all of that. But there's a question here. What's missing in this picture?
And so that's a question, and I will pause and look at my audience and ask, what's missing in that picture?
Gravity.
Gravity, correct. What I started by talking about was general relativity and gravity. Here on this side that I'm calling the force mediators, we've got electromagnetism, we've got the strong force that governs the structure of the nuclei, we've got the weak force. Where's gravity? We should have another quantum that is the force carrier for gravity in that column. Now, one of the really nifty things, from my point of view, about string theory is that consistency of string theory seems to demand the appearance of a graviton. I simply can't write down a string theory without including a graviton. And in fact, if I think about physics not on the stringy scale, but at much larger distance scale, it turns out that string theory naturally gives us Einstein's equations. And so that's an equation that looks like this. On this side, I've got some geometry stuff. On this side, I've got some matter stuff. And here, of course, is a constant that we all know about. That's just the Newton's constant that appears in Newton's law. Now, if this is supposed to be, or string theory is supposed to be able to describe that, what this is telling me about is something about how gravitons, or gravity, interacts with the matter particles. And I said that string theory had a rule about how interactions take place. And so it must have a rule on what Newton's constant should be. And in fact, that's the case. In string theory, Newton's constant up to H bars and C's gets related to the string scale. And so that's why I'm saying that I expect the string scale to be this very small number, because we've measured Newton's constant, we know what H bar, we know what C are, and so if I just plug them all into this formula, what comes out is a length, 10 to the minus 35 meters. And so what we have then is a mathematical framework or a model, namely superstring theory, which naturally unifies all of the physics of quantum field theory and the standard model with the physics of gravity and general relativity. Of course, that's a 30-second... Oh, another question.
Is the Higgs particle required for string theory?
The Higgs particle, again, is an ingredient that we can produce, but we don't in detail know the structure. Or we... ask me again in 2 minutes. So what I gave you was a 10-minute introduction to string theory. It all seems very simple. What could go wrong? Well, the devil is in the details. There's a few more details to string theory that I haven't talked about, as you can imagine. And sometimes it seems to make predictions that aren't in accord with the universe that we know about. So in particular, consistency of superstring theory, again, seems to demand that we don't have just the dimensions that we know about, but that we have 10 space-time dimensions. As I said, you know, when we look around this room, well, we can go forward, backward, left, right, up, down. So there are only 3 spatial dimensions that we know about. You have to also remember that time is a part of the picture, and so we only have 4 dimensions to play with in our experiments in the everyday world. Well, what's the big fix? Theorists are very creative. Maybe we just haven't looked hard enough. Maybe those extra dimensions are very small. So the analogy is, we can think about the tightrope walker, you know, with the physics that she's concerned about, or the tools she has at hand. She thinks of the tightrope as a one-dimensional object. She can either go forward or backward. She's not going to be thinking about going up or down on the tightrope or left or right. But on the other hand, if I think about a tiny bug whose resolution of the universe is much smaller, that bug can move forward and backward, certainly in the same way that our tightrope walker can. But they can also, the bug can think about walking sideways and going around the circumference of the rope. And so similarly, in our space-time in string theory, perhaps the extra 6 dimensions here are curled up very tightly, and with the experiments that we've done so far, perhaps we simply haven't been able to probe these extra dimensions here. Now, one of the things that I always like to emphasize is that this is not an embarrassment of riches, but rather this is an essential ingredient of string theory. What I described was a theory which part of the beauty of it was its simplicity. It had one scale, a length scale that told me how big strings were. It had one coupling constant, one interaction that told me how the strings interact. But if I look at physics in our universe, it's an extremely rich physics. It's a physics of many interactions. There's electromagnetism, the strong force, the weak force, gravity. And it's also a physics that displays or shows interesting phenomena on many different scales. And so if I had a successful string theory in four dimensions, it simply wouldn't describe the universe that we know about, because it would only have, you know, a single interaction and a single scale. And so it couldn't describe the richness of the universe that we observe. And what we do, though, in string theory, when we curl up these dimensions in different ways, what we do is we produce different kinds of physics in that macroscopic four-dimensional universe. And so we've changed the perspective on physics. When I see a new interaction, I'm not adding a new particle to the theory. What I'm doing is I'm changing the geometry, or I'm engineering my 10-dimensional theory in a different way. And so it gives us, again, a geometric perspective then on how all of this physics, this rich physics that we see around us could arise. What's another of these details that are kind of embarrassing? Well, it predicts that there are lots of extra particles that we haven't seen. In particular, the super and superstring theory comes from the word supersymmetry. It's an idea that in the theory, every fermion or every particle, matter particle, should be accompanied by a bosonic partner. The bosons were the people the particles in the force carrier problem. And so if we look at that list of particles that we had for the standard model, what we see is, well, the column with the fermions had far more particles than the column with the bosons. And similarly, the properties of these particles and those particles were just simply very different. And so we don't see supersymmetry manifest in the standard model. But again, as theorists, that doesn't really bother us. Perhaps we just have to look harder. One of the benefits, again, is that it's really because of supersymmetry that string theory works out to be consistent. One of the great challenges in unifying gravity with quantum theory is fluctuations at the very smallest scales. And it turns out that in string theory, supersymmetry is one of the essential ingredients in taming those fluctuations, in removing uncertainties or removing divergences, infinities, that would otherwise appear in the equation. Details, details, details. Well, here's another detail. This is more from a philosophical perspective, but one of the things that people noticed in the 1990s was that there were many different ways, or it seemed there were many different ways to build a consistent string theory, or at least five. And so those different theories went by various, you know, esoteric names there, type 1, type 2A, type 2B. But if it's supposed to be a theory of everything, well, doesn't that mean we have two or four too many theories of everything? We've only got one universe. Why should we have five different theories? And, well, a new perspective that's been developed or understood in the past, I don't know, 15 years or so, is that, in fact, all of these theories that seem to be different theories are in fact different phases or different solutions of a single fundamental theory, which now goes by the name M-theory. So, just to give you an idea of what's going on there, what are some of the ingredients? How do people understand that? One of the buzzwords you might hear is the buzzword duality, or dualities. It's misspelled up there. Sorry about that. But the idea there is very simple. It could be that sometimes in trying to write down physical theories that I write down two different sets of mathematics, but then when I start to ask physical questions, even though the mathematics looks different, I get the same physical phenomena. So a simple example of that is thinking about string theory on a circle. So here I've written down a circle, I've depicted it as a large circle, it's got some circumference that I'm characterizing by 2 pi times r. So this might be one of those extra dimensions that I'm going to curl up. Here again I've written a circle, but I've given it a different radius, and I stuck the string scale in there. So this is a number that I might see in string theory. But if the string scale, if this is a macroscopic number, this is a tiny number, and so this circle would have a circumference that's much, much, much smaller than the first one. Now, if I've got particles and I'm in a quantum theory, those particles have a wavelength. And so when they move in the circle direction or they move around the circle, that's going to put constraints on those particles. Well, here I've done the relativistic thing, I've related the momentum to an energy. But what quantum mechanics is going to do is it's going to tell me that when I move around the circle, the wavelength had better be I better have an integral number of wavelengths in order that I can have a standing wave around this circle. That's similar to the idea that that there are energy levels in an atom, that the wavelength of the electron had to be tuned to the circumference of the orbits, or in the Bohr model anyway. And so if I put those formulas together, here's the circumference, here's my Broglie formula, what I get is a spectrum of states with energies that go like some integer, which is a number of wavelengths, divided by r, this radius during the circumference. I can do the same calculation over here. The radius, or this, the quantity that characterizes the circumference is slightly different, and I end up with a formula like that. Now again, you know, if I'm doing quantum field theory, or if I had point particles, this is the only thing that I could do on a circle. I could move the particles around, or I could give them momentum. And so I end up with a spectrum here and a spectrum here, but those look very different, and so the physics is different. What I'm talking about now is string theory, and so there's something else we can do. If we have an extended object, we can actually wind it around the circle. So what I'm doing here is I'm taking a string and I'm wrapping it around the circle some number of times m. It's being extended, this distance, the circumference. The strings all have a tension or an energy density. And so I get an energy in this simple way. I take the tension times the circumference, the number of times I've wrapped it around. The tension of our strings is related to the string scale. Here's my circumference. And so putting that together, I get a very simple formula for my so-called winding modes, that the spectrum of those states is, again, an integer times the radius divided by the string scale squared. I can do the same calculation over here. The only thing I'm doing is that I'm replacing r by l squared divided by r. Now, if I look at the spectra, or the set of states that I have at the bottom, now, in fact, for a string theory, it looks like they're the same. These states all have energies that are the same as those states, and similarly, these numbers here look the same as those numbers there. And so as long as I don't insist that winding modes here should match winding modes here, but I just ask that the physics is the same, that the total, you know, when I look at the total spectrum, that there should be the same energies here as on that side, then I can identify the physics of these two string theories. And in fact, I should identify winding modes here with momentum modes on that side and momentum modes here with winding modes on that side. And so that's an example where then I started with a mathematical framework that looked different. A large circle, small circle, but at the end of the day, the string theory told me that the physics, the spectrum of the theory, is the same. And so that's a duality or a relationship that goes by this name, p-duality. That's interesting. So what else do we have? Well, another important thing that we learned in the past 15 years, or about 15 years ago, is that string theory is not just a theory of strings. In fact, there are all sorts of different kinds of objects that are an essential or essential ingredients that can't be avoided in string theory. There are strings, there are also things extended in two dimensions called membranes. There are things that can be extended in even more dimensions, given that I have 10 dimensions to play with. An essential, well again, these are objects in the string theory, and so they have energy densities or tensions that are related to the parameters in the theory, and so there's a string scale that appears in the formula, but there's also a coupling constant here. And so what people found is that these objects, these other objects here, are very, very heavy when I'm thinking about G being small. The thing is that usually we thought about G being small because that was an easy place to calculate. But it's also clear then that these heavy objects don't play a role there. They've got energy densities that are huge, and so they can pretty well be ignored. But if we go to a regime where G is now very large, or we go to a strong coupling regime, it's harder to calculate. But it's clear that the energies involved here will be of the same order as the other springy objects, or the strings, in the theory. And so it turns out that these other objects, known as D-brains, play an essential role in understanding strong coupling physics for these theories, which allows us to connect some of these different string theories. And the puzzle, as it's seen now, is that we have, in fact, a number of different constructions of string theory, but they are sort of different phases, or they map out the boundary of the whole theory, which is this M theory. And in fact, you might note in that picture that I talked about five string theories before, but there are six corners there. So in fact, there's a corner up there that I didn't talk about before, but it's something that seems not to be a string theory, seems not to be 10-dimensional, but rather it seems to be some other theory that involves membranes and other kinds of objects in 11 dimensions rather than 10 dimensions. So that's the M theory, and so I should have, rather than having the proposed pedestal here being, or foundation being string theory, we now should use the words that the foundation there is going to be M theory. Okay, well, how do we make progress from there? Well, I told you about the unification of different ideas in the past, but an essential ingredient here was actually experiment, making physical observations. Now, we can estimate where, you know, these two theories should come into conflict or produce inconsistencies. Whereas it was the atomic scale here, in this case, it's in fact a much smaller scale. It's known as the Planck scale, or this 10 to the minus 35 meters. So that's a scale that's some 17 orders of magnitude or 18 orders of magnitude away from present experiments and or the resolution of the best high-energy or particle quantum experiments that we have. So how are we really going to make contact between this beautiful theory, this elegant theory of physics on small scales, with experiments that we can really do with apparatus that we have? And so here's one proposal, I don't know. But in fact, string theorists are working hard. And so, you know, I said that, well, you know, what quantum theory said is with more energy, more momentum, I get shorter wavelengths, I get better resolution, and so, in fact, these experiments are done not with microscopes, but these particle physics experiments are done with colliders that accelerate particles to higher and higher energies. And, in fact, here at in Switzerland, there's a new experiment that's turned on and grinding away. And if you ask the experimentalists, you know, what are you looking for, some of the leading candidates that they hope to be able to see there are supersymmetry, or even perhaps extra dimensions, or perhaps even direct evidence of strings. Now, In fact, you've just, at the LHC, increased the resolution by one or two orders of magnitude, and so how are you going to see screens when I said they were some 18 orders of magnitude away? Well, the truth is that I lied to you a little bit. And there are ideas that, in fact, even though in a standard scenario, the string scale is tiny, it may be that it's actually much closer to experiments than we know. And these ideas rely on the fact that we have extra dimensions, but that we also have brains or D-brains. And so it could be that the standard model physics that we do is in fact confined to a brain of some kind, whereas gravity or the space-time geometry actually sees the full extra dimension, and those extra dimensions may not be at down at 10 to the minus 35, but rather much larger. They may even be a millimeter in size, or, well, a millimeter is now ruled out, but a relatively speaking large length scale. And the advantage is then that the Newton's constant that we measure in our experiments isn't the Newton's constant that appears in string theory, but rather there are factors of this volume. And if I have a large volume there, what that does is it brings down the natural scale where the strings appear. And so there is some hope that perhaps string theory is within reach, even though we've only increased our resolution by one or two orders of magnitude. Another place to look is not by going to smaller scales, but rather turning our eyes upward and making cosmological experiments. The idea there is that, well, we know now that we sit in a universe that's expanding, but if we run our clock backwards, what that means is that as we go back in time, the universe shrinks. And if we go sufficiently far back in time, the sizes, the scales, the energy densities, the sizes become small, the energy densities become huge, and so we may reach a region where, in fact, the physics of strings is manifest in the very early universe. And so in this case, then, the entire universe becomes our microscope, and what we have to do is understand the optics here and understand what imprints this stringy physics down here may have left on our cosmology up there. And so two possibilities are illustrated here. Perhaps there are subtle imprints in, say, the cosmic microwave background or the detailed pattern of radiation that we measure from the early universe. Or an even more exciting one is illustrated here. Perhaps some of those strings which were propagating or shooting around in the very early universe got caught up in that expansion of the universe, so that rather than being microscopic in size now, they're actually stretched to cosmological sizes. And so it could be that, in fact, there are networks of strings on cosmological scales out there that could be observed, not with a microscope again, but instead with a telescope. So those are some of the possibilities that people are playing with. But it's really true that this is one of the major challenges for string theorists and for string theory, is how do you make contact between this beautiful, elegant theory on the Planck scale or on the string scale and experiments that we can do on practical scales with machinery or apparatus that we can build today. There's another aspect which I think remains a challenge or string theory. One of the things you may encounter, or that you would certainly learn if you study string theory in more detail, is that it draws on an enormous range of different kinds of mathematics. So I started off easy here with complex analysis, which is something you may know about, or group theory. It wanders into fiber bundles, gerbs, topology, K-theory, derived categories, non-commutative geometry. So these are many, many, those are just buzzwords, so you don't have to worry about the details, but these are many, many, again, different kinds of mathematics that people, in fact, might devote their lives to studying just this aspect of mathematics, or just this aspect. And yet somehow, in many different ways, they seem to play a role in string theory. And I think the real problem here is that each one of these topics or set of techniques is useful to describe certain features of string theory, but that we don't really have a language, a proper language, to describe the full or the big picture. And so we're really, what we have are different pieces of the puzzle. We may see how these pieces fit together in certain instances, but we really don't have the right language to describe the full puzzle or the big picture at this point. And so the other challenge, as I see it, for string theorists is to come up with the appropriate language, or for theoretical physics, the appropriate mathematics to really understand this elegant theory in a coherent way. I mean, the analogy would be, it would be like Einstein trying to describe general relativity without knowing or without having the tools of differential geometry at hand to build on in his physics. So I started with a historical perspective, and I'm going to end with a historical perspective. And that is a reminder that at the beginning of the 20th century, or in the early 1900s, in fact, a major raging debate amongst theorists or physicists was the idea of atoms. And there was a school of thought that said that we shouldn't build physical theories based on a concept like an atom, because it's an object that we'll never be able to physically verify. It was just beyond reach, beyond our imagination. And yet, as you know, every school child today is taught about atoms. And in fact, less than 100 years after that period, using techniques like something called atomic force microscopy, not only can we see individual atoms, we can manipulate individual atoms. And so illustrated here is an interesting experiment where what they've done is they've arranged a set of atoms in an ellipse. And the experiment is that by putting another atom here, it makes a certain, at one focus of the ellipse, it produces this excitation or this bump in the electron cloud at the other focus. And so I see that as an analogy for string theory, that we're really talking about entities which at present seem beyond reach, but the nature of the theory is such that it draws an enormous amount of interest. It's provided an enormous rich set of ideas, and so people continue on this journey, but it's a journey that's only beginning. And then as a last slide, I'll say that, well, the web is the source of all information these days, and so if you'd like to learn more about string theory, here are some resources that you can find at the official string website. Here it says that it's the 21st century, it's time to feed your brain. So with that, I'll close and thank you for your attention.
So I think we have a good time for questions. 25 minutes.
You ask questions. Why don't we start over there?
Why is it that some strings are open and others are closed?
That has to do with this idea of, or the way we understand the string theory, but also the idea that there are other objects, namely these D rings, and so. The way we understand it now, or the way that we understand the D-brains, one of the ways we understand them, is that they're actually surfaces or they're objects whose excitations are, again, described by strings. But those strings are strings, then, that are supported or that end on those objects. And so an open string would be something that's tied to a particular brain. And so, for example, in that brain world scenario that I talked about, if standard model physics lived on a brain, it would be the physics of open strings, whereas gravity propagated through the entire space-time, and that would be then the physics of closed strings.
Where did this idea of strings come from in the first place?
Mm-hmm. That is a good question with a long answer. So it had its roots in actually particle physics and in trying to understand in the 1960s various aspects of, you know, people were doing these collider experiments and they noticed certain curiosities about the processes in that they could be described. Let's say I take two particles and I collide them. I could think that what happened is I created a third particle that then scatters or decays into other particles. So this is stuff coming in the accelerator. This is stuff coming out in my experiment. But what they found, and what you would have to do is you'd have to sum over all the possible particles. But what they found as theorists was that they could describe that same experiment this way, where I'm now summing, you know, now my particle comes in, it shoots out some virtual particle and scatters into the detector, but that virtual particle then gets absorbed over here and causes this one that came in to go over there. And there was this curious behavior that I'm seeing stuff here and stuff here, but it seems that I'm talking about different theories. In string theory, that's perfectly natural in that I have, you know, a world sheet. And so what these two pictures are either I divide the world sheet like that, and I say there are particles going that way, or I divide the world sheet like that, and I say the particles are going that way. But I have a single world sheet. I don't take this and that and add them together. There's only one thing that I need. And so it was really through this obscure feature, which now really doesn't have to do anything with the string theory that we talk about here, but it is a feature that's manifest. This was actually the first time that the word duality was used.
In your little diagram, where does strings come into play?
Sorry?
Well, in your diagram on the top right there, where does strings come into play?
Well, this particle that comes in, I'm describing it as a string. And similarly, this is another particle that's a string. What I said was that when strings interact, I just, you know, make bigger loops or decay. And so in describing this interaction, I just draw a two-dimensional world sheet. So I have a one-dimensional object, it sweeps out a surface or a two-dimensional sheet as it propagates in time. That's this tube coming in, another one here, two going out. The net interaction is just some blob here in the middle. But again, what I can do is I can cut that blob in two different ways to give it two different interpretations. Sure.
How do you know all of the separate string theories join up to make M theory?
Well, I gave you some of the ingredients, the D-brains and the dualities, so the concept of dualities. And so there's a course worth, or maybe 2 months worth of lectures that would go into the details of how you connect. I had this picture with the hexagon. Oh, no, I went the wrong way, sorry. Can we get there? I had this picture, and so, you know, there are labels here on all of these edges, and so, you know, the T-duality that I talked about actually allows us to relate this theory, the details of which I haven't given you, to this theory, the details of which I haven't given you. But there are other kinds of dualities that show us how to link the various other kinds of string theories together. So it's something that people have worked hard at, and it was another one of these profound insights that happened, I think, around the mid-90s, and then people working through the years to piece together these different pieces of the puzzle. And so I'm just giving you the final answer that what we believe is how it all fits together.
I heard
something a while ago about when I was talking about t-duality, am I talking about, I've also heard about have you heard about like the big balance, the big bang is,
It may be the idea, maybe this picture is. I mean, what I'm saying here is there are big circles and small circles, but they're the same. So you might have the concept then that there's somewhere in the middle, there's a minimum size. And then I don't have to talk about sizes that are smaller than that because I can always reorganize the physics as the physics of big
things. And then that makes it easier to work with, right?
And the, where am I going? Yeah, I also talked about, I'm going the wrong way, I'm sorry. I also talked about the universe and how it was contracting. And so I guess some people have tried to apply that idea that you can't get, that the universe couldn't have gotten arbitrarily small, that they couldn't have gone to arbitrarily small scales. Rather that, you know, at a certain point I should reorganize my physics or reorganize my thinking, and rather than thinking about a contracting universe, I should think about an expanding universe.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. I'll move on.
Okay. At the beginning, when we were talking about string theory, and you said it was linking quantum quantum physics and general relativity.
Yeah.
We said it did that because it predicted the graviton. But is just like, is predicting a particle enough to recreate all of general relativity? No.
There's a subtlety there. In fact, the answer is yes, but I won't go into the details. But in fact, I said more than there was just a particle. What I said is that when I think about the physics and how it's organized, it's not just that there's a so-called spin-view particle propagating around, but it interacts with everything else in a very specific way. In fact, in a way that at some large scale looks just like Einstein's theory.
Right.
So there's this extra ingredient. I mean, it's not just that there's a spin-view particle, but in fact I'm getting something that looks just like Einstein's gravity coming out of this theory. I'll come back to you, okay.
So is the Higgs particle needed to verify string theory, like a standard model, or not? Or it's not needed?
Again, the if I discovered the Higgs particle, I would not have discovered string theory. I need something more exotic than that. If we go beyond, if we just try and understand quantum field theory or the standard model, if we don't find a Higgs particle, well, for the theorists anyway, that would be even more exciting than discovering the Higgs particle. If we discover the Higgs particle, well, then physics is just, there's some details to work out, but it's basically physics that was invented 40 years ago. If we don't discover the Higgs particle, that says that there's something profoundly wrong with the way we're thinking about physics at that scale. Not 10 to the minus 35 meters, but 10 to the minus 18 meters. We don't understand something really simple, what apparently is simple, but something profound. And so for theorists, it would be a real, it would be a joy and a pleasure not to discover the Higgs particle, because it would mean that we have to restructure our understanding of the theory at that scale already. In the green.
All right. I've heard that these extra dimensions that are curled up in string theory take the shape of a mathematical function. I'm not sure exactly. It's like Kabel-Yau shapes.
Kabel-Yau, yeah.
Can you explain the significance of that specific shape? Like, why do those dimensions take that shape?
I could, but it's also not true. What it was is that in the earliest days, in an era around, say, the late 1980s, early 1990s, what people were trying to do is come to grips with this idea that I had to curl things up. I also wanted to, what I said is that geometry was producing, or had to produce, the interesting physics that we see in our four-dimensional world. And so
what people did is they started studying Calabi-Yau's because it was a simple way to get something that was consistent, essentially, not with the four-dimensional version of this equation, but the 10-dimensional version of this equation. And so, you know, here's the geometry, and so that geometry already has to, you know, satisfy certain restrictions. But those restrictions have been alleviated now because we've become more creative, we've become bolder, we've become bored with Calabi-Yau's. And so now, as well as geometry in the internal dimensions, we're adding extra stuff on this side of the equation. And so we don't have to satisfy the same restrictions anymore. And so people are moving away, they're exploring a bigger space of theories that in fact give an even richer set of physics. These new kinds of compactifications are essential in understanding these cosmological models. They're essential, or they give an interesting way to develop these new scales that I talked about. And so Calabi-Yau was sort of a starting point, but it's not sort of the end of the story. And people are really moving beyond that and exploring other kinds of geometry. Actually, part of what they're doing, as well as exploring the geometries, is, you know, again, developing the mathematics to describe these new geometries at the same time. Sure.
You talked about one of the properties of the superstring theory is that we have extra dimensions, but how we can prove that experimentally? At least, how? Because I think that we can understand only dimensions.
No, but it's again, it's a matter of having. Well, okay. So there's. Where do we have? Well. Remember the T-duality picture. Let's say that, you know, this is one of our dimensions and it's curled up. If I want to probe that dimension, what I need is a sufficiently small wavelength, I'm saying here. I need a wavelength that's shorter than the size of this extra dimension. And what that means is that I have to go to a very high energy. And so, if we were able to go to sufficiently high energies, presumably I'd start to see stuff wander off or leak into these extra dimensions, and it would just become manifest. And in fact, that's one of the exciting, or it's one of the things that people spend their time in calculating, you know, for these brain worlds. We're doing physics on the brain, but if these dimensions are very large, you don't need that much energy to go in those transverse directions, but you do need to be, you know, leaking energy into the gravity part of the theory. You can't do it with the standard model part. So if we were in this, one of the ways you would detect it is by seeing the energy leak off into the extra dimensions. And so this would be a very hard experiment, but it's something that in principle can be done. How about you?
Earlier you talked about a string as something that, or particles coming out of strings because of their rotations or their vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
But you also describe strings as a one-dimensional object. So
mm-hmm.
How can a one-dimensional object rotate? Or is it relative to something else?
Here's a one-dimensional object. There it's rotating. One of the things that when it rotates, it does is it has angular momentum. And so if I look at different particles, what I notice is that, you know, they have different amounts of angular momentum. And so maybe that's how, you know, you're getting that quantum number or that characteristic of the particle to come out through the rotation. I don't want to wander there, but you may be asking something deeper about Mach's principle and stuff like that. But I think it's just a very, there's nothing terribly deep there. It's just the idea that you know, something rotates around, it's got extra properties. It's got this angular momentum, and it's different than other particles.
Okay.
No, you don't have too many questions.
I've got two questions. So, first of all, are there the predictions of string theory? Do they at all contradict the predictions of general relativity and quantum mechanics on a scale larger than the Planck length? And also, when do you predict that we will be able to either confirm or refute string theory?
Well, what I said is that you really only run into trouble with the theoretical framework when you get down to the Planck scale. And so using the tools that we have now or the understanding, I mean, it's probably not, it's an archaic way of trying to describe physics as you approach the string scale or approach the Planck scale, but it's not something that really runs into, you know, that breaks down until you get really down to that scale. Whether or not I'm going to see strings tomorrow or 10 years or in my lifetime really depends on how lucky we get. You know, I talked about atomic physics or atoms. The thing that changed people's mind was not atomic force microscopes, which happened, you know, 90 years later. It was a simple observation of Brownian motion and understanding that in terms of atomic collisions on a particle sort of floating on a surface of water. And so what we really need is a bright person, perhaps one of you, to come up with the Brownian motion experiment of string theory. And I really don't know, you know, I'm not going to make a prediction. You know, there are various possibilities that are explored. You know, the LHC, that's a reality. That's happening right now. It's running not quite up the spec, but it's something that's going to be dominating particle physics for the next 20 years. And so it could be in that time span that we see evidence of string theory. This is actually an observation of what people thought might be gravitational lensing from a distant galaxy. That could have been confirmed last year. In fact, when they looked at it with higher resolution, they discovered it was two separate galaxies, and so it's not a candidate for a string. But that kind of experiment, again, is something that can be done now. And it's, in that case, it's a matter, again, of being lucky and looking in the right direction. And it's also a matter of how gracious nature is to us and what she offers us. Perhaps there are other scenarios where these cosmic string networks simply don't arise. And so maybe that'll be a dead end. But again, that's giving the string theorist input in that if you don't see anything actually from gravitational wave observatories in the next 10 years, that basically rules out a broad class of theories. And you know, the string theorist can use it as a diagnostic. If your compactification or your cosmology produces these strings, well, you know that's not our universe because, you know, a certain set of experiments haven't seen them. But it means you've got a career ahead of you if you're interested.
I wanted to ask, how do scientists determine how many dimensions there are, whether it was like 10 or 11?
That becomes one of these really interesting questions in that what I said is that In our puzzle here, we had all these 10-dimensional theories, but somehow they got linked to an 11-dimensional theory. And so it turns out that sometimes, you know, there are dualities, say here, that are relating big and small circles. But sometimes there are dualities where you're relating geometry or a dimension to some other kind of physics. And so... It really, in some instances, becomes a non-question. You can either describe the theory
using an 11-dimensional geometry, or you can describe the physics using a 10-dimensional geometry. But it's really, I think, pointing me, or I would point you back to the question that I asked, which was, you know, when you talk about geometry, or when we talk about geometry and dimensions, we're in some sense using classical geometry. We're using concepts that were invented, you know, hundreds of years ago. What this is saying, in some sense, and the T-dualities and all that, is that string theory really lives or demands a more interesting kind of stringy geometry, where, you know, in some instances, you can think of it as a classical 11 dimensions or a classical 10 dimensions, but that there's really some other language that's going to unify those together and say that, well, no, those are just different aspects of stringy gravity or stringy geometry, rather. And so asking the number of dimensions in some sense becomes a classical question, but string theory somehow seems to incorporate all of these different theories or different phases together, hopefully in some coherent new set of mathematics that uses a different kind of geometry. Yes. Yeah.
How can we imagine that we live in 10 dimensions?
I sit in my office and stare at the window. I'm not sure what the question really is. I mean, do you want to know how I draw pictures, or how I reconcile that with the fact that I only see 3 plus 1, or
how can we imagine that?
How do I visualize it? How do I draw pictures? Very cleverly. I actually don't, but you know, there are people. Wherever it goes. Yeah. So there are clever people who you know think about visualizing geometry, again classical geometry, and so these pictures here, although they're kind of fuzzy, probably. Are supposed to be visual representations of a six-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold. Don't ask me how that works. Although that's not one of those profound questions, there is an answer somebody knows. It's just not me. But there are, you know, there are people who work on visualizing you know, these higher geometries, and the reason is probably, which is behind your question, is that pictures give us a lot of intuition, and they're useful in trying to understand, you know, the mathematics or the physics of these shapes.
Is it possible to show that strings do not exist? Like, can you refute M theory?
Can I refute M theory? Personally, I think, yeah, the answer is yes. In principle, if I could do experiments, you know, at a length scale or with a resolution of 10 to the minus 35 centimeters, you know, it could be that you discover strings and some, you know, bouldering geometry, or it could be that you just, you know, you understand it in terms of discrete atoms of space-time or you know, some other theory. But you know, as I was saying, that's an in principle thing. What you, as well as proving, you know, I think the Brownian motion experiment, whatever it is, would, you know, it would make a prediction. And if you don't see that prediction, that would say that, well, you know, string theory was a great idea, it gave us a lot of ideas, but it's not the way that we should describe physics in our, you know, in our world. So for me, at least in principle, I think it's possible, but again, it really, to make that contact with experiments, we're really going to need a clever new idea, and a bright young new mind.
So let's have maybe one more question and then break for lunch.
How about two questions?
Okay.
We'll start with Michael.
So if string theory does work out, just the probabilistic nature of, like, that comes out in quantum mechanics disappear, or is it still present
Well, as I described it, when I it may be that it gets superseded by some new ideas when I understand the right mathematics. But certainly as we describe it now, you know, I talked about these strings joining and that there's a probability there, a coupling constant. And so as we understand string theory now, all of the quantum theory just gets melded into the bigger string theory. We don't have to give up on quantum theory just yet.
How are antiparticle interactions described by strings?
So the idea is that a scattering of any two particles, antiparticles, it doesn't matter, are described by this same kind of a picture here. When what differentiates the different kinds of experiments is the precise boundary conditions, or what comes in this tube and this tube. So this could be an electron, or by changing the boundary conditions, this would become, you know, an anti-electron or a positron that scatters off of an electron. And so it's really that geometric picture that I had before is still applicable, and it's sort of this universal geometric picture that describes everything, and that was one of the beautiful or elegant aspects of string theory. Okay. So Richard wants to cut things off. If you'd like to ask me informally questions, feel free to come up to the front, but I don't think they count for the draw. I don't know if Richard's making
a rule. They're going to count for the draw, so I'll hang out. And so come on down to the front if you have more questions. For the rest of you, Bistro is the place for lunch.
Hey, guys. Can you please face your dirty...